Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here, and we're going to talk about food with you today to begin our program. Usually going out to eat, hopefully, for me, it means good company, hopefully interesting conversations, delicious food. What about having gourmet meals without having to leave the comfort of your own home and with little or no fuss when it comes to preparing that food? We'll find out how you can do that today with world-renowned chef Jacques Pepin. Jacques is a celebrated chef, teacher, author, television personality. He spent his 60-year career sharing impeccable culinary techniques with us and making fine cuisine feel approachable to cooks of all level. His latest book is Jacques Pepin, Heart and Soul in the Kitchen, and it's a companion to his current TV show, Heart and Soul. Jacques, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's wonderful, and I'm so enjoying your book.
Good.
It's right from the introduction. You know, I thought immediately, finishing reading that, or while I was reading it, first you made me so hungry, and you made me really want to come to your house for dinner.
Okay. Right.
And that's kind of what the book's about, is it not? Isn't it some of your favorite recipes and experiences at home?
Yes. I mean, I have done, 26 show television series in the last 30 years, and some of them have been, and I've done many books, and some of the book, I did a book for the Cleveland Clinic for cardiac patients. I did one on Shortcut My Way, thing like that. But this one is really what we eat at home, and so in a sense, it's all over the place, because my wife being born in New York from a Puerto Rican mother and a Cuban father, you know, after 50 years of marriage, there is a lot of things which come, and she loves Chinese and Japanese cooking, so we have some of that as well. So it's a little bit of everything, but, you know, the food which means something to us.
Well, and you grew up near Lyon.
Yes.
And I think that's kind of considered the gastronomic capital of France. How did that influence you as a young person?
Well, I didn't know any other place anyway, but when I was very young, it was the war, and during the war, we didn't have that much to eat, so I remember from age 6, 7, I was in the kitchen with my mother because she decided to open a small restaurant. My father was a cabinet maker by trade, and by the time I was 13 years old, I finished a primary school, which was required by law, and then I left to go into formal apprenticeship. That was in a town about 40 miles from my hometown. And that's it. And from then on, I worked in Paris, in Lyon, a little bit all over the place. So that has become my life for the last 65 years or so.
It has to have been a wonderful life for you. Boy.
Well, cooking kind of gratified me, and it satisfied me. I hope that I made a lot of people happy in my life, and in what we do as cook, especially in our time of political correctness, where you cannot talk about race, gender, weight, policy, religion, so everyone talked about food. You know, there's a common denominator, and everyone eats. And I feel that when people see me, hopefully I bring a smile to their face. I mean, there is no, as I say, political application or anything in what we do. So just making people happy and sharing food.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. And as I said, I love your book. And you know, I love the stories that you tell along with the recipes.
Uh-huh. Yes, thank you.
They're absolutely wonderful, and I must also tell you that I love the photography in the book.
Yes, Tom Hopkins, a friend of mine who lives here in Connecticut, where I am, I'm sure you can recognize my Yankee drawl there. anyway, he's been photographing books for me for the last 30, 35 years. So I don't know, eight or ten books he's done with me, and he's really great.
Oh, it's for me, I love a cookbook with photos, and yours are absolutely wonderful. So it's, to me, it just kind of helped. I don't know why.
Good.
It's nice to be able to see something before you see something already prepared before you try it yourself. I guess that's the way I look at it.
Yes, I mean, people look at picture and hopefully it makes them salivate and say, oh, that looks good. And then they get into the recipe. Can I do that or whatever? So that's good, yes.
And you're, I have also noticed, and I think you mentioned it, but just bears mentioning again, that the recipes are ones that almost anyone, I think, can do.
I would think so. I mean, you see, what happened is that when I was a chef in a restaurant, and in a great restaurant, if you go and do a demonstration, even write a recipe, I mean, your idea is really to entice people to come to your restaurant. Whether they can do it or not is relatively unimportant. Sometimes it's too difficult, you know. But I don't have a restaurant anymore. So the food that I buy at the supermarket, the best that I can find, but still at the supermarket, and I make it for the home cook, you know, so that's what I do. I teach cooking.
We have we are talking today with Jacques Pepin, who is the author of many, many wonderful cookbooks and television programs. His latest book is called Heart and Soul in the Kitchen, and really a collection of many recipes, many of the things that he cooks and prepares in his own home, and things that you and I can prepare, and they're lovely, and they look just absolutely fantastic. You may want to join in, maybe have a question or comment. I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page title, The Larry Mealer Show, and certainly on our page, we also have links to his cookbook, and how you can obtain it. And we have callers online, so let's go to the phones. Barbara in Portage, thank you so much for calling. What's on your mind?
Good morning, Larry. Good morning, Chef. What an honor to talk with you.
Good morning.
Good morning. I have I love baking bread, and I have recently begun using your recipe and method for the long-proofed baguette. I saw it on one of your programs, and so I decided to try it. I do one little thing differently, and as a result, my loaves come out a little different every time, so I wonder if you have any suggestions or hints. And this is what I do differently. Instead of making the four baguettes out of your recipe, I only make two because I have one of those lovely double baguette pans with the holes on the bottom.
Well, at that point in French, it would be called abattard. Abattard, you know, I mean bastard, really. But abattard bread you buy in a boulangerie, you know, in a bakery in France, and it's about twice the size of about the same length that a baguette, but about twice as wide. So that's
correct.
What you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yep,
okay.
That's what I'm doing.
Good.
And what happens, Barbara, there's a problem with it, or?
Well, it comes out different every time. I don't quite have the timing right, or because you have to bake it a little bit longer, of course, than the smaller, thinner ones. I put the water in a pan in the bottom of the oven, and you know, so it gets the steam, and I get that crispy crunch, but not really, really crispy.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it doesn't rise as much as it should. It's a little paler. So just any hints, temperature, time, anything like that.
Yeah, any of this count. I mean, in fact, you know, this is the paradox in a recipe. You cannot really do the same recipe twice. It's not possible. I mean, you never have a chicken with exactly the same amount of fat And you cook on gas, you cook on electric, you cook with copper, you cook with aluminum. It's humid, it's not humid, it's summer, it's winter. You're in a good mood, you're in a bad mood, you're a hangover. So there is no way that the recipe can be exactly the same. And that's what being a professional chef means. When you work in a kitchen, in a professional kitchen, the food comes out hopefully exactly the same each time. And in order for that recipe to come out the same, you change it each time. Of course, we don't use a recipe. You just go by taste, look, you taste, you adjust, you taste, you adjust. And most of the time, it's even subconscious. You don't even realize it. But the food comes out the same at the end. So, you know, when you do your bread, if you really know your bread and you do it over and over again, eventually you massage it so that you do it and it comes out exactly the same, because automatically you're going to adjust. Today it doesn't brown as much as the last time. You increase your temperature, or it's more humid, so it grows up more, it grows less, or it's cold or whatever. And those are the small adjustments that you have to do as you cook along. And frankly, for me, when you do a recipe, I would hope if someone used my recipe or any other recipe, that you would want to do it exactly the way the recipe is written at least once. You know, and if it comes out good, then you're likely to do it again. So the second time, you take a faster look at the recipe. At the third time, you may not even look at it. And by the fourth time, you, quote, improve the recipe. You massage it to your own taste. You like a little more tomato in it, or you like it less dry or more dry or this or that. And eventually, a year later, you may not even know where that recipe come from. It has become your recipe. You massage it to your own style and your own taste. And that's a normal progression. And if someone does that with my recipe, then I feel gratified.
Perfect. Thank you.
That is a wonderful comment. Thank you so much for that question, Barbara. And Jacques, thank you for that answer. What a wonderful answer.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it very much. And let's go to Charlie in Chicago, who has a question as well. Hi, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Bonjour, monsieur.
How are you?
Thank you for taking the call.
Yes.
Quick question. What's a great one-pot wonder I could make for my family in this fall season?
You mean pizza?
No, a one-pot wonder. I think he wants something in one pot that combines everything for a meal.
Oh, yes, yes. I have several one of those in that book. I have one certainly done with kale, rib, sausage, and lima beans. And, you know, you start with a couple of the ingredients, and an hour later you put more of the ingredients, and eventually you have a big pot of that you can do ahead, that can be reheated, can even freeze it. So, yeah, those type of big dishes, I have a few in there, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Fantastic. Kale, sausage, lima beans, I got it. Merci.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. Jacques Pepin, our guest today. He is the author of a dozen cookbooks, including the one we're talking about today, Heart and Soul in the Kitchen. That's the title of it. I hope you'll join in with your own questions, comments, or maybe stories about cooking as we visit with him. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page title is The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller. Rebecca Haas, our on-air producer today, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, having a great time visiting with Jacques Pepin about his latest book, Heart and Soul in the Kitchen. And again, you can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And speaking of Facebook, Celeste wonders on Facebook, what is your favorite dish to eat in this season?
Well, are you asking me that question?
Yeah, she's asking you. She, I think, is a big fan, to be honest,
yes,
of your work, and wonders what you enjoy the most in the fall, as we go into the fall season.
Well, you know, it has a lot to do with what's in the garden, I still have a few tomato in the garden. It has a lot to do with offering in the market. I mean, the season is coming, so it's starting getting cold. And just for lunch here, we had a soup that I did with some leek and a sweet potato and, you know, what often my wife calls fridge soup. I opened the fridge, and whatever is left here and there, I cut in pieces and make a soup out of it. So this is the beginning of the cold season here. And, yes, I'll go for soup, stew, that type of thing. I mean, I don't think that I have one favorite dish. I don't really think that anyone has a favorite dish. I mean, if you ask someone, if someone tells you, I don't know, raspberry ice cream, well, summer, winter, it's cold, it's hot, you're in a good mood or not. I mean, you're skiing. No, of course, sometimes you want a soup, sometimes you want. But for me, I usually try to stay in season, whatever is good at the market. I mean, there is no question that when you buy tomato in the full season of tomato, that's when they taste the best. That's also when they are the least expensive. It's also then where they are nutritionally the best. So, you know, why not follow the season?
And there are some, now this time of year, there are some vegetables that are kind of cold, cool weather vegetables that are come into their own right now and are wonderful to be eating.
Absolutely. Parsnip, you know, sweet potato and all of this, the leek. So, yes, that's what I use.
Peter in Illinois, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, nothing so much on my mind as to give Mr. Papat a compliment.
Thank you.
I noticed at the end of the series years ago that my wife and I used to love to watch when you were cooking in the kitchen with Julia Child.
Uh-huh.
I found it so admirable and entertaining, the kindness that came through from you toward her when it was apparent to me that Julia Child, she just was not the same as she used to be. And you brought out everything good.
Good, but thank you.
And I really thought you would have been a, you know, I'm a retired teacher. I showed my kids even old tapes, and I said, now this is an admirable quality, and I used you as an example. I just want to thank you for being a good role model.
Well, thank you so much. You know, I met Julia in 1960, so, you know, I knew her for the last 45 years of her life, and she became you know, we were good friends, and that's what good friends do. I mean, there is no better place to share wine and food than to cook together in the kitchen. I mean, the table is the great equalizer. I mean, you know, people invite you to their house. You have 10 people around the table. You may be sitting next to the, I don't know, the CEO of General Motors, which in a normal situation probably will never talk to you. But around the table, no one knows who they are. And, you know, the table is the equalizer. You talk and you enjoy food.
And I just love the way you let her have her head when she would come a bit, become a bit obstinate.
Oh, yeah, no, good.
Oh, Peter, great call. Thank you so much. Very much appreciate that call, as I do all the calls. We have great listeners, and they usually have wonderful comments and ask great questions. Fritz in Duluth, Minnesota, it's your turn. Hi, thank you for
calling. Hello, and thank you for the opportunity to speak with you, Jacques Pepin. I have great respect for you, and I've watched many of your programs, and I really appreciate your style and what you do on the television. I do watch that frequently when I can.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you a question regarding the herb saffron. I'm a chef, and I've worked in kitchens, and I've like saffron cream, paella, bouillabaisse. I'm just looking for a different application that would be something different with the saffron regarding a sauce or making something with it. That's the first part of my question. Then the second part would be, what are your maybe top couple of elegant sauces that you like for, you know, fine presentation?
Well, to start with your first question, the saffron is very, very expensive. You know, it's the pistil of a crocus flower, and it takes, I believe, something like 75,000 crocuses to do a pound of saffron. So the real saffron, the best one, come from Spain, I believe. In the south of France, we have some too, from Iran and places like this. There is other type of saffron, like the one in Mexico, will give you the same beautiful golden color than the saffron, but doesn't have the same taste at all. So, I mean, for me, there is nothing which replaces the real saffron. In a rice, for example, or in a paella, certainly, or in a bouillabaisse, as you said, which is the fish soup. Yeah, this saffron is the best. Unfortunately, it's very expensive. But when you get it, you can freeze it in a little quantity. I put that in the freezer, and I use it when, you know, very often at the end of a dish to get the maximum effect in it, you know. So otherwise, the best sauces that you ask for me, I don't do as much sauces as I used to, but I still do a nice brown stock when I have chicken bone, and I keep that in my freezer. And that brown stock now, in turn, I can use it whether I do a pepper steak or whether, like next week, I'm doing a dinner at Boston University where people pay a great deal of money. So I will do a truffle sauce with it. I have some peeling of real truffle and that brown stock that I mentioned and some Madeira wine, and that really enhance a piece of meat, you know.
Ah. Wonderful. Fritz, thank you so much for calling. David in Madison has a question. Thank you for calling, David.
Hello. Thanks for having me. It's as somebody said before, it's a great honor.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask the chef what he thought about what the WHO had to say about red meat.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, for me, I've been teaching cooking for 45 years, and 20 years ago, we could have only one egg a week. Fortunately, we're back to two eggs a day now, and then we couldn't have any butter, of course. People gorge themselves on margarine, which was worse than butter. And so it goes, one thing after another. Now, you know, I don't think they are right in many ways. To start with, in processed meat, if you do a salami as I do at home, or prosciutto, in the old way, all you do, you take ground meat, you put salt in it, you put it in casing, and you hang it in the cellar. And the same thing with prosciutto. So there isn't much processing in it. And I don't know whether you have to stop eating all of that type of meat. It's carcinogenous or whatever. But, I mean, to put that in the same category than tobacco and alcohol is wrong for me. So, you know, I'm not going to change my diet that fast, you know.
I don't think I am either.
And where you, if you get your meat from locally sourced farms, or if you buy it from the grocery store from like some big huge farm, exactly. It's a completely different animal.
Exactly. I mean, you know, when I tell people to avoid any kind of processed food, but I talk about package that you take in the supermarket, that you open it, different type of snack or whatever. You don't even know what it is. You look at the list of ingredients, there is 40 ingredients. And even worse so now, the kids not only choose this, but now they put color on those packages. So you have those little kids who choose by color. Say, I want the red one or the blue one too. I mean, this is so far from the food itself. You know, I always think, I mean, certainly I have a granddaughter and kid. I take them to the garden to send them where the food comes from and how it's processed. But those packages, yes, I try to avoid it, but I don't agree that with the sausage or hot dog or any of that stuff.
You will continue to eat.
Yes.
All right. Thank you, David, for calling. And Manette and Hubertus, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Good morning. First of all, it's fabulous. Thrill and honor to speak with you.
Thank you.
My question is regarding venison and elk. I oftentimes have access to those meats, and I get them from friends in a stew meat form oftentimes, but I can't seem to get the meat not to be dry.
Oh. Well,
because it is so lean, do you have any suggestions?
Well, it depends what you do with it. I mean, certainly the best part of the meat, which is going to be the rack, the back, the loin, and all of this, you do it in a steak, which should be rare, and saute. I mean, I have a recipe in that book here where I deglaze with a bit of vinegar. It goes well with it, and then a dash of ketchup to thicken it and give it some sweetness, and you can do a little steak like that, saute, and it's going to be really nice and moist if you do it, you know, medium rare to rare. As it comes to roasting it, then the shoulder would be about the best part, or a stew. Otherwise, frankly, very often we do hamburger with it, and I have also recipe in that book. As I say, I have found out my friend Jean-Claude upstate New York goes hunting with his bow and arrow. Every year he's got a deer. And we use those pieces, as I say, the rack in one way or the other. But as it comes to a lot of the other meat, we ground it and then mix it with I like the brisket, you know, like the Jewish big brisket and the thick hand of the brisket are a fair amount of fat. And that way I ground and mix it with about the same amount of deer meat and so forth. And it makes the most wonderful hamburger you ever had.
It sounds wonderful. The vinegar sounds like a great idea, too.
Yeah, vinegar and a bit of sometimes a bit of sweet jam like gooseberry or you know, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a kind of acidic jam goes well with it, yes.
And do you have a red wine suggestion to go with venison?
Yes, free wine. If you invite people, they should bring wine. And any type of free wine is good for you. You know, venison like that will sustain a fairly heavy wine, you know. So you get into the Bordeaux type wine or in Syrah or even Malbec from South America, Argentina, and so forth will be good.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Very good. Thank you so much. It was
Thank
an
you.
Honor.
Thank you so much for calling. Well, now back to wine for a minute, because there's a wonderful story in your book about the fact that someone gave you two $7,000 bottles of wine.
Right.
And what did you the story, the best part of it is what you did with the wine.
Well, I gave it to a friend. To a friend who is crazy about wine and got a big collection. And for me, I get bored with that. I mean, it's not that I don't. But, you know, when you go to those extremely rare wine and you have like one tablespoon of it and you have to analyze it and to... It's too much work. I just want to have a glass of Beaujolais and relax.
I love that story, and I'm so glad we have the chance to tell it. Michelle in Milwaukee, it is your turn. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. I'm so happy to speak with you, Monsieur Pepin, and I wanted to say first I loved your book, Cooking with Claudine, when I was, you know, in my 20s and learning to cook. And now that I'm a parent, I wondered what are your thoughts on cooking with young children, say 5-6 years old?
Yeah, well, you know, to start with, I was in your beautiful country. I just came back the day before yesterday from Milwaukee. I mean, I was actually at Kohler, Wisconsin, you know, for the Food and Wine Festival.
Yeah.
I have been there a couple of times. Oh, I think like 5-6 times now. And, you know, this is a great place. First, people are very, very friendly. There is great demonstration, food. I mean, I had a very good time. I was with my daughter, and we gave classes there. But I have a granddaughter as well. And in that series of 26 shows, that new series that goes with my book, she does, I think she did at least 4, 5, or 6 shows with me, as I did with my daughter when she was younger. And for me, it's very important that the kid get involved into the kitchen. You know, when my daughter was a year old, I hold her in my arm and she stirred the pot. You know, so she stirred the pot. She, quote, made it because she stirred the pot. So she was going to taste it. So you have to get the kid involved in the kitchen. And for me, I don't think there is any better place than the kitchen for a child when he comes back from school. I mean, the smell of the kitchen, you know, the noise of the equipment, I mean, the voice of your mother, your father, the taste that you have there, I mean, that stay with you the rest of your life. But you have to start the kid when they are young, when they are babies.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for that question. And so you just give them little things to do?
Yes, absolutely. Little thing to do. I mean, my granddaughter now is tall enough, but when she wasn't, she stepped on a stool next to me in the kitchen, and I said, stir this, after that, there's this, there's that, what do you think, and so forth, you know.
And Michelle, thank you again for calling. Debbie in Spring Green, thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
Well, first of all, like everyone has said already, I'm just so pleased to be able to talk with you.
Thank you.
Oh, my goodness. I have all of your books, and I have learned so much over the years, and it's kind of an interesting segue from what you just said. So I was in the kitchen with my father when I was little, and so developed a love for cooking. And then as he got older, he sort of got stuck in a rut of the 50s type of cooking.
Oh.
And so I remember trying to give him cues, and then you, in one of your books, you talked about Steak Diane, and that was the first exchange between my dad and I on changing his approach.
Uh-huh.
And he found it so easy, and was so proud. And so whenever, for like the next probably 15 years, whenever someone came over, that's what he would make.
Yes, well.
And it was so lovely. And I just I'm so pleased to be able to talk with you. I'm so nervous. I can't stand it.
Thank you. No, but, you know, you do something that you love, and by doing that, you give a lot to someone, you know, and there is no way, you know, that you could cook indifferently. You know, you have to put yourself into the food, and people know it, feel it. I mean, the cooking of a grandmother or a family member, you know, there is a great deal of love in it. I remember reading in Gabriel Marquez, Love at the Time of Cholera, I think, and in there is the man character, which is Dr. Urbano, something like that, and he has a new housekeeper in his house, and she serves food. He doesn't even know there is a new housekeeper, but he smells the food, tastes it, pushes it back. He said, that food has been cooked without love. They didn't know him. And there is a great deal of truth in there, you know. And when you put yourself into the food, there is something which comes out, you know.
And Debbie, thank you.
Oh, thank you. I just want to say I'm cooking professionally now because of you.
Oh, good. Oh, Matt, I ruined your life.
No. It's all about love. I agree.
Thank you so much, Debbie, for calling. That's a great question, a great story. A Facebook question from Kathy, who needs an answer pretty quickly here. I just started dinner, which is a 4-pound whole chicken, which I have placed seasoned butter under the skin and spread over the skin on top. It is now resting in the fridge until it's time to cook. I was thinking about slow roasting this in the oven with some potatoes and carrots.
Mm-hmm.
What oven temperature and how long should I roast it? And should I do it covered or uncovered?
Well, to start with, Julia Child would be very proud of you with all that butter that you put under the skin and above. But for me, just salt and pepper. I usually start the chicken on its side because it takes longer to cook through the thigh, you know, the thigh and the leg. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I even take a knife, and I make a little bit of incision between the thigh and the drumstick, because in that joint here, it takes a longer time to come. I do the same thing with the turkey, so that you don't overcook the breast, you know. I usually would cook my chicken uncovered, that's for sure, and you have to baste it. And if you cover it, the steam goes in it, and it kind of falls back, and it kind of stays reheated. So now you do it uncovered. I do it at 400, 425 degrees. I do it at high temperature, and the chicken that size will take a good hour. And by the time, after 10, 15 minutes, you can put your potato around, some carrot, onion, whatever, and continue cooking it and basting it. Make sure you do it in a good pot, that is a thick, heavy aluminum pan or one of those, not like a light stainless steel pan, because the heat transfer in the stainless steel is not too good, and you will end up with black burnt spot in the bottom of your pan, and that ruin your juice. So that's important.
Wow, very excellent advice. And Kathy, thank you for that question. And now you're going to be able to tell whoever you're serving that, Oh, I asked Jacques Pepin about this today, and he told me how to prepare this.
Oh, boy. Okay.
That's a, that'd be something nice to be able to say. Oh, man. Did Sandra wondered if you're, if living in Mexico changed your cooking styles at all.
Yes, I mean, we just sold an apartment we had there, and we used to escape the winter in Connecticut like 6 weeks to 2 months out of the year. And we did that for a dozen years. And certainly the people in the Yucatan Peninsula there, we went to Playa del Carmen, are really very, very nice people. And for me, wherever I go in the world, I'll go to the market first, and I buy the food of that market, whatever is fresh. So, of course, it does influence you, all the different type of pepper. And I have my friend Rick Bellis, who also does show on TBS, and he's a great, maybe the greatest specialist of Mexican cooking. So he advised me on the type of pepper that I bought. And, yes, you get used to it, and there is some influence. Sometimes the influence is kind of insidious. You know, you don't even realize it. And all of a sudden you realize you put more, you know, pico de gallo in your soup or some more coriander, you know, cilantro or more... hot pepper, you know, so sometimes it, certainly I don't cook now the way that I cook many years ago, but on the other hand, the book that I did, especially on technique, do not really change, because the way you sharpen a knife or the way you bone out a chicken or beat an egg white is the same now than it was 50 years ago, you know.
Well, and your book is just a lovely, lovely book, cookbook, and I'm so glad to have a copy of it, and so glad that we were able to talk with you today about it. And I trust the book is selling well.
Well, I hope so. It does.
Oh, Jacques, would you come back and be with us again sometime?
Sure, with pleasure.
Oh, I would love to have you back. Jacques Pepin is obviously a very celebrated chef, teacher, author, television personality, 60-year career. Spent sharing impeccable culinary techniques with us. His latest book, Jacques Pepin, Heart and Soul in the Kitchen. It's a lovely book, and it's really a companion to his current television show, Heart and Soul. So wonderful to have him with us. And you know what? We're probably going to be continuing talking about food. At least that's going to be part of the conversation coming up as we talk about life on a Wisconsin dairy farm a little bit with someone I love talking to, Inga Wisher. She's with us next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.